CMC Markets is one of the world's leading CFD and spread betting providers with more than three decades of experience. Trade with CMC and you're trading with experts. 79% of retail investor accounts lose money.
Hello and welcome to The City View, the podcast from City AM in partnership with CMC Markets. Join me, Christian May, each week as I talk to insiders, industry chiefs and leading figures from business, finance, politics and the media. My guest today is, I hope, a familiar voice and name, Rachel Cunliffe, City AM's comment and features editor, a position she has held and excelled in since I recruited her 3 years ago. She's done a number of these podcasts this year, of course, and is also a frequent contributor to the BBC and Sky News. But from next year, she will appear on those channels, not under the City AM banner, but under a new flag, that of the New Statesman, for Rachel is off to be their deputy online editor. And while the New Statesman and I rarely converge on an ideological point, it is to their immense credit and good fortune that they have snapped up someone like Rachel, someone who is wise, thoughtful, loyal, intellectually curious, and an excellent writer. She's certainly no Corbynite, and I expect that as the New Statesman plots a course in a post-Corbyn world, she will be of huge value to them for the way in which she understands, if not always agrees with, the politics and the economics of the right. And I would hope, after 3 years of working for me, the preferable qualities of a free market and a liberal society. But if that's not the case, she can put it in her own words, because she's with us now. Rachel, welcome to the City View.
Thank you. That's very, very kind of you.
Well, I've had plenty of time to think about it, Rachel. As you know, as others know, I'm also leaving City AM. I've got a few final obligations in the form of this podcast, but I'll be starting work elsewhere in January. So I've really been on gardening leave for a couple of weeks now, and I have in fact been gardening, which I've enjoyed enormously, but I've also just been thinking about the shape of these last few podcasts, and I'm very pleased that you're going to join us as we approach the end of the year. So where shall we start in this conversation? Let me start by asking if you've managed to negotiate the rules for Christmas and whether you've settled on a festive bubble.
Actually not. Christmas plans very much up in the air. My family, as you know, we're Jewish, we do Hanukkah. This was actually going to be my first ever Christmas. I have a Christmas tree for the first time, and still working out really how those 5 days are going to work. But I know the pub is going to feature heavily. That is something that I really missed over the last month. And I think as the days get shorter, a bit of pub Christmas cheer, nice festively decorated, and really supporting, doing my bit to support London establishments that have been struggling over the last months. So I think that's going to be the highlight of the Christmas period for me.
Well, I'm sure there are plenty of places that will throw open their doors to you. And so keen am I for a dose of normality that I'm heading to one of the UK's two, or is it three, small tier one areas, the Isles of Scilly. This isn't just an extravagant search for freedom. This is, of course, for me going home. And I haven't been back to Scilly since... When did I last go? I think when we marked my younger brother's 30th birthday there, and that was in January. So I think this is certainly the longest I've ever been without a visit home to the Isles of Scilly. And I'm taking my three-year-old son with me. And, of course, as per the rules, we will abide by our own Tier 2 rules while we're there. That means no going to the pub, no leaving my parents' house, really, though that's no hardship. But there are now just tiny pockets of the country that are able to enjoy anything close to normal. I spoke to my mum earlier. She'd been out for lunch with some friends on Scilly. But for a lot of people, that still remains completely out of reach. And, you know, as we approach Christmas and people start to really think about who they'd like to see and whether they can do it, it is a reminder, alongside what excitement there may be, that we really are still in a dreadful mess. And it's been such a difficult year for so many people. Are you encouraged by the vaccine news today, Rachel? Or do you think that might just be another large-scale government infrastructure project waiting to go wrong?
Well, I think we had a conversation at the beginning of this fairly early on, where we said with the government failure over PPE and testing and care homes, and when it was very obvious that Britain was not having a good pandemic, that that was only the start of the game. And if we could manage to get the rollout of a vaccine working smoothly and comparatively quickly compared to other countries, if we could get our populations vaccinated so we could get back to work sooner than perhaps other countries, then when we look back on how we handled the pandemic, that would really be a sign in Britain's favour, and that people might be more forgiving in retrospect of some of those early on mistakes, if it is the case that the government has learned and learned from those mistakes and certainly improved at logistics. And it is heartening to see those multiple vaccines, firstly, within the space of a few weeks of each other, which really shows the innovation and the power of the private sector to really do something amazing, extraordinary in the course of a year. And now the rollout is pretty much going to get underway, I think, early next week, which is something that we should be immensely proud of as a nation, while obviously recognising that it is a global effort. These are global companies and scientists and doctors who come from all over the world that have made that happen. So I do feel positive. On that front, I think also like you, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts, actually. I'm a bit worried by the risk-averse culture that seems to have really dominated the government and indeed public sentiment, it would seem, for much of the year. And there seems to be a tendency, the precautionary principle of if there's any risk at all to something, maybe we shouldn't do it just in case. And I think that might have been very beneficial at the height of the pandemic. But if we are going to move forward economically and also in terms of society, we perhaps need a healthier, more robust attitude to risks and to cost-benefit trade-offs. Is that something that you also worry about?
Well, I think you're right. And I think you can contrast that now quite deep-rooted sense of being a risk-averse nation with the conduct of the pharmaceutical giants, who have moved heaven and earth and indeed moved most of the standing rules to pull together this extraordinary breakthroughs we've seen in vaccine technology, and things that normally take 2-3 years longer even have been produced, have been confirmed viable within a matter of months. And if you can imagine a point where we just look back on 2020 and we identify two or three or four of the main elements of this miserable story, of course, the human toll, the economic consequences, which we'll be talking about for a long time and feeling even longer. The third must surely be that scientific cultural revolution, if you like, because the heads of these giant pharmaceutical companies have talked openly about how they disregarded the rules, and indeed in many cases they deliberately kept politics and bureaucrats out of it. They just wrote blank checks to their research team and they said do it, and they did it. And so one of the questions is there any benefit in reintroducing those old processes and ways of doing things in a post-COVID world if doing away with them served us so well whilst we were battling with the disease? And I imagine that's something that many businesses and institutions all over the world have barely begun to consider yet. I mean, we've all talked about, you know, working from home revolution and all of the changes to the way we work, but there are much bigger questions now that people will start to have to ask and find answers to about whether the way in which we've worked, and again, I'll cite the pharmaceutical companies as an example, can really provide us with fertile ground for the way we could work in the future, because it is one of the most extraordinary scientific, even commercial endeavours that we've seen for a very long time, the way in which these vaccines have come to the fore. And you bear a thought also for the head of the UK's vaccine task force, whose name, I'm afraid, escapes me, but she got a lot of stick for hiring PR people and flying around and doing all sorts of things, but frankly, she's done one of the best jobs in government. I think she came from a venture capital background, and she has procured an extraordinary quantity of vaccine. She's done it ahead of many other countries. I know it's not something we should look at as being a competition, but far ahead of many EU member states. And this could become, you know, one of the, and we certainly need to find a few, one of the silver linings of this crisis. Now, of course, to go back to that earlier question, it will all rest on the rollout and the deployment of this vaccine. But you saw the health secretary giving interviews today, and he looked genuinely like he had a spring in his step for the first time in a long time.
Yes, he has over the last 9 months looked like a man who was having a nervous breakdown live on air in each subsequent interview. So it was nice to see him a bit bouncier, the old Tigger bag. I think Tigger's his nickname. And I think the vaccine success story and the power of businesses to be agile and to adapt, that really is a success story with technology, with the way that businesses just, I mean, we talked about it right at the start in March, but it's still kind of amazing to think that overnight, in a matter of days, entire businesses changed what products they were making, where their staff were, what their security protocols were. They invested huge amounts in making workplaces safer. They invested huge amounts in technology and having people across the world being able to work remotely. That level of agility and adaptation within a few days, weeks or months is something that if we would have been having this conversation at the end of 2019, will we be able to adapt to things happening in the future? We would have taken, I think, a much more pessimistic view. And I think one of the silver linings, as you say, has been we have learnt as individuals, as businesses, as organisations, how quickly we can change when we have to. And that's just a very positive thing to know for the future when we're facing future challenges. We've also learned that some of the governments and state organisations that were set up with the intention of being able to deal with these things actually were some of the ones that had the most disappointing results. So there's a kind of state planning versus individual ingenuity story there that you could tell, although I imagine I'm going to be having lots of arguments about that when I start my new job in January.
So in the last few minutes, you've lambasted the inefficient state apparatus and sung the praises of the private sector. This kind of thinking is clearly exactly why the New Statesman hired you, and I look forward to that being your first column.
Well, I said I would bring provocative pragmatism to their way of looking at this. That's my selling point. But I do think it's important not to think about the role of governments and the state versus businesses in traditional left-right conservative Labour boxes, because a huge amount has changed since those labels started to become commonly used. I think a huge amount has changed just in this year alone, when we look at people who want the state to take a bigger role in every aspect of life, which is what they've had to do, and those who have looked at government decisions over the last year and thought, okay, I can see why they needed to then, but I'm a bit worried that those same arguments could be used in the future for more state control. That's not a left-right kind of dichotomy. That's about liberalism and freedom versus statism and sort of government control over people's lives. And I think that kind of breaking down of distinctions is healthy, and hopefully that's something that I hope to see more of in 2021.
Well, that sounds like exactly the sort of talk that would appeal to Jason Cowley, the esteemed editor of the New Statesman, and a man who I like and admire very much. So I like the thought of you two working together. But you pulled us onto politics, so let's have a look at the politics of the pandemic. Now, I've just joined the ranks of people who catch a bit of news at 10 in the evening, and that's about it for me, compared with the way I used to follow every raise of the eyebrow on the front bench, or every early day motion, or every twist in Westminster. I've rather enjoyed this sort of liberation from the granular obsession. But it does strike me that there are a couple of things to consider now. The first is quite how many Tory MPs rebelled against Boris Johnson's latest COVID strategy. And the second, of course, is Keir Starmer's Labour Party deciding to effectively ignore the vote completely. How do these two things look from your perspective?
Well, I'm in the odd position of thinking that Keir Starmer actually made the best decision available to him by abstaining. He doesn't have to he didn't vote with the government, which meant that when things go wrong later, he can criticise the government and not have the, well, you voted for this, this is on your head too, accusation thrown back at him. But if he had voted against and enough Tory rebels had joined him in that, then the government would have lost its vote. And then you're in a position of pure chaos with a few months to go before Christmas, which can then be blamed on the opposition. So I know he's getting a lot of flack for captain indecision. No, Captain Hindsight, General Indecision. That's what he was called today. I don't know anything about the army. Is that a promotion?
Yeah, the promotion.
It's going upwards. But I think if he can take the flak now, it puts him in a more flexible position in January when we are looking at the economic impact of those tiers, and he's managed to keep his hands clean on that front. The other thing that it's done is drawn attention to the deep, deep divides in the Conservative Party. All of the focus is on those 54 Tory MPs who voted against the government and the 16 who abstained, which suddenly makes that 80-seat majority that we were talking about 12 months ago, like it was going to be fixed for the next 5 years, suddenly look very fragile. And I think it's worth remembering that the Conservative Party isn't one thing. It has never just been one thing. And the idea that once Brexit had happened, all of the internal divisions and factions would just cease to exist. Those factions that had really caused trouble for David Cameron and Theresa May wouldn't be an issue for any future Prime Minister. That looks quite naive, actually, in hindsight. There are always going to be awkward Tory backbenchers making life difficult for Tory PMs, I think.
Yeah, the size of that Tory rebellion this week was pretty dramatic. And on the one hand, as you've just suggested, you could say that with the vaccine being rolled out, these rebels will have made their point and they pose no real harm to Johnson's government. But on the other hand, as you did, you can argue that they've gained a taste for rebellion. And with caucuses springing up all over the Tory benches as MPs gather under various banners, those from the north, those from the 2019 intake, those worried about China, maybe even then with the pandemic in the past, as it will one day be, Johnson isn't as secure as the size of his majority would suggest.
No, and that makes it interesting for us, I guess, or certainly for journalists continue to watch it. I remember us having a conversation at Christmas last year when we were saying, basically, has politics stopped being interesting? Because you've got a prime minister who's incredibly popular, has got a majority. The most contentious issue of the age, which was Brexit, has been settled, although a year later it hasn't been settled perhaps quite as comprehensively as we thought it has. It's certainly looking more difficult for him. And I don't know, you know him, I think, better than I do as an individual. I have watched Boris Johnson over the course of the last year. He seems diminished. He seems less excited about the job than he's not the bouncy London mayor campaigning Boris that I seem to remember. I wonder how much of that is it's been a crisis that would have worn out any world leader. And certainly, if you look at some of the other world leaders, none of them are looking particularly happy about what we've all been through in the last year. But do you think that he's got a taste of being prime minister and now wonders if maybe he might like a quieter job, some gardening perhaps?
No, I don't. I think you can count on Boris Johnson to cling on to the keys of 10 Downing Street for as long as he possibly can. And he's already clearly thinking in those terms, given that we see now he's hoping to repeal the Fixed Term Parliaments Act and restore to the Prime Minister the prerogative of determining when an election can be. Because if he can delay tax rises for a few years, maybe he'll want to go to the country before they kick in. Anyway, he's certainly thinking about the future. And I also think that it's worth just remembering that he became prime minister, his life's ambition, in December with that huge majority, although it's not as coherent as perhaps we first took it to be, but it is still a huge working majority for day-to-day business of governing. And just a few weeks later, he would have had advisers saying, I think we should pay attention to something rumbling in Wuhan province in China. And is it Wuhan City or Wuhan province? I forget. But you know, within weeks of achieving his life's ambition, people were starting to talk to him about COVID. And then you know what it's been like since then. So I think you can forgive the man for looking a bit run down and for probably being politically frustrated that he can't do all the things he said he was going to do and wanted to do. But he might be able to start doing them, public finances notwithstanding, by the spring, by the summer, and then it's still a few years until he has to have an election. So I would imagine that he will recover the spring in his step. But listen, Rachel, we're going to have to start wrapping this conversation up. But let me just end by asking you, and I hope you can answer, what your highlights have been during 3 years at City AM, or at least what you've enjoyed about the job that you've done for us.
Well, I wanted to end by thanking you personally for offering me the job 3.5 years ago. It has been such an adventure. I joined just before the 2017 election, and I think the theme of that particular era for both of us has been, it's never been like this. It's politics will never be the same again. This is not normal. This is new and exciting, and it has just progressed that way. So covering those big political events, and seeing kind of firsthand how the city and businesses have had to respond to them, and indeed how businesses have pushed back against a wave of really uncertain and confusing sentiment from Downing Street in the world, has been just incredibly exciting. And thank you for giving me that opportunity. I think it has been a particularly unusual, high stakes, high drama couple of years. But then again, maybe that's just politics the way that it is now. I certainly think that the relationship between business and politics has really come to the fore with Brexit, with COVID, with the big tech companies. And a lot of the questions that we're asking of our political leaders now are actually business questions and economics questions. And it's been wonderful to be at the heart of all that. So thank you for taking a chance on me when I had zero business experience. I hope you feel like you made the right decision and that it's gone well.
Well, I certainly do. And it's been a pleasure talking to you today. And it's been a pleasure working with you for the last 3 years. And I may very well ask someone close to me to take out a new Statesman subscription for me as a Christmas present. But I'm sure we'll talk again, and I certainly look forward to meeting again. But for now, Rachel Cunliffe, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The City View, the podcast from City AM in partnership with CMC Markets. Do join me again next week.
CMC Markets is one of the world's leading CFD and spread betting providers with more than 3 decades of experience. Trade with CMC and you're trading with experts. 79% of retail investor accounts lose money.